Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day.
Hello and welcome to The Breakdown, brought to you by The Nation Magazine and TheNation.com. I'm Chris Hayes, Washington editor of The Nation. Each week here on The Breakdown, we take your questions via Twitter at Chris L. Hayes or via email at TheBreakdown@TheNation.com. The way it works is this. You send us questions about what's perplexing you this week in Washington, and we try to break it down.
Will I run to the rock? Please hide me, I run to the rock. Please hide me, I run to the rock.
Hello and welcome back to The Breakdown, week 26, episode 26 in a collector's series. I guess we've been doing this for half a year now. This week's question comes from Serafina on Twitter, Serafina Churchill. She says, can you break down the new Wall Street reform bill? I suppose if I was being a total smartass, I would say yes and end the breakdown broadcast. But I won't do that, and because it's a great question, and it's part of what I love about breakdown listeners during perhaps the stupidest news cycle since, like, I guess lipstick on a pig would be the last time the news cycle was this mind-drainingly idiotic. Our listeners want to know the nuts and bolts of this massive new piece of legislation that was signed this week, and we are happy to provide it. We have on the line Mike Konzel. He's a former financial engineer, a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, and he writes a just indispensable blog about finance and the economy. It's called Rorty Bomb. It's at rortybomb.wordpress.com. He's contributed to The Atlantic, NPR, and The Nation. Mike, thanks for coming on The Breakdown.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, Mike. So this financial regulatory reform bill is signed into law as of yesterday, I believe. What do you think are the best parts of the bill, the parts of the bill that you are happiest are in there that you sort of view as real pieces of progressive policy?
Well, let's walk back a little bit and talk what went wrong in the financial crisis. So if you look at the lead up to the financial crisis, you had a couple major problems. One is that there was a large amount of consumer fraud in the subprime market. You had people who were taking out mortgages that were being oversold to them. And then later that naturally attracted people who were more than happy to be complicit in fraud. So you had a really bad system of consumer lending that was very exploitative. The next problem you had is the derivatives market. You had something like the AIG problem, which is when you had a crisis, you had huge overlapping and interconnected positions with these very complicated instruments that have a tendency to explode. So AIG is a normal company that does insurance, and it had a line of business that was failing, and that happens all the time. The problem with derivatives is it had this failed position that was willing to take down the entire economy, and we didn't know about it in advance. No one knew about it in advance, market or government, and there was no real fair and systematic way to actually resolve those positions. And the last problem was something like Lehman Brothers. Going back for a while, whenever we had a large company that acted like a bank fail, we didn't resolve it like a bank. We didn't have the legal powers to. You know, your commercial bank can fail and it doesn't destroy the entire neighborhood.
Explain why that's the case. Your commercial bank doesn't destroy the entire neighborhood because since the Great Depression, we've had a system of deposit insurance, and the FDIC comes in and basically says, okay, no one panic. We're insuring the deposits. We're going to unwind this bank, as they say, and sell it off or reconstitute it and make sure that people have their savings intact.
Exactly. You know, the bank goes down on a Friday, it's back up on a Monday. And that's a system that's worked since the 30s. It's really one of the modern achievements of the modern state when it comes to regulatory successes. So how do we extend that to a lot of firms that are acting like banks, so they're not incorporated and chartered as a bank? And then to keep with that, we had a problem where a lot of things were behaving exactly like a bank. They were taking in money and lending it out, but they weren't regulated like a bank. You know, Lehman Brothers is another example of that, but a lot of places, GE Capital, you had a lot of firms that weren't taking in deposits. They weren't, you know, corner savings bank, but they were lending out money in the mortgage market, for instance. But they weren't holding capital. They didn't have proper adult supervision or toilet training, as they say, like the normal banking sector does. So how do you take that and give them proper regulation? This bill extends the regulatory umbrella to firms like that.
So I want to run through this. So we got four things. You're saying, you know, if you're going to look at some main causes of what got us this moment, this exploitative, poorly underregulated system of consumer finance that levered people up beyond their means, you've got these what we call dark markets and derivatives, right? Which is that, and we've done a breakdown on the derivatives, so listeners might know a little bit about that. But basically, lots of liabilities that no one can track. And so as soon as someone's about to go down, it's like, oh my God, God, you owe $30 trillion, or whatever the outstanding notional value is. And then you're saying there's this problem of resolving. Resolve is sort of the technical term, right? Of when a bank fails, it's very different than when a manufacturing company fails or a laundromat fails, right? It can create panic and bring the system down. So we need to figure out how to deal with something like Lehman Brothers. And then finally, you're saying there's all these things that are in what's called the shadow banking system, right? Things that act like banks but aren't regulated like banks. So those are your sort of four big what got us here things. And I maybe step through how the bill does on each of those four.
So the consumer finance actually came out really well. There's going to be a bureau at the Federal Reserve called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The government does a lot of consumer finance protection, but it's usually the third or fourth priority among 12 different agencies. And whenever, you know, something is subservient to, you know, protecting banks or helping banks out from the regulator's point of view, consumers usually get neglected. So consolidating a lot of what the regulators do anyway with a place that has it as its primary purpose, we think is going to actually be very helpful. Now, a downside there, something that's bad about that, is that there's a big carve out for auto dealer lending. You know, the auto dealer lending market, it's usually the second biggest loan average person will take out during their lives. And there tends to be a lot of fraud, a lot of kickback, a lot of misinformation there. So that's a genuine loss. To their credit, the Obama administration and Treasury went to bat for it.
Went to bat to close that loophole and have auto dealers included.
Exactly. Yeah. They tried to stop it. You know, the auto dealers are just very powerful people.
Yeah, it's very funny. You know, it's something I didn't learn until I moved to Washington, is how powerful auto dealers are. In Washington, part of it is that, like hospitals, which are also very powerful on Capitol Hill, everybody's got some in their district, and they tend to have money, and they tend to have sort of influence.
Exactly. They're everywhere. You know, the community banks are also very powerful. They're quasi-excluded. They're excluded in the way it's enforced, but they have to follow the rules, which is a major win when you think about it.
So we have the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. It's going to be housed in the Federal Reserve, but it's going to have its own sort of independent head. And all in all, you'll give that a kind of passing grade with the caveats of this sort of carve-out for auto dealers.
Yeah, A-minus, definitely.
Okay.
At least.
All right. So that's that. Then now let's move to derivatives, which really, if you were to say, what was the one thing that transformed what was a shock to the system into a full-fledged existential crisis, I think you would have to say derivatives, right?
Right. You know, they've done a lot of good things since they've, you know, really taken over the market in the 70s. But in a lot of ways, they're used to conceal information, avoid tax law. And, you know, in general, they make things a lot more complicated. It makes it tougher for businesses to regulate each other and kind of hold each other in check inside the financial sector. So what regulators decided to go with here is to have them all go through something called a clearinghouse and to implement a form of exchange trading. So to simplify that quickly, clearinghouses basically mean you always have one guy standing in between all trades. And same way, you know, it's like a bookie.
That's a great
way to think about it. And the firm in between everyone makes sure that everyone's posting enough money.
Yep.
And if they take a loss, they share the losses across everyone. So everyone has incentive to make sure that the game's played well.
I think one way to think about it is the difference between tickets you buy on Craigslist and tickets you buy on StubHub. If I scalp tickets off you, Mike Konzel, on Craigslist, and like, you know, no one knows about that transaction. And, you know, if you screw me or whatever, then that's just sort of what it is. But if I buy it through StubHub, there's this third party that's actually sort of engineering the transaction, actually guaranteeing, right, the delivery of the tickets.
Right, yeah. And if you sell 10,000 fake tickets to a local venue off Craigslist, which you could do, you know, it's very harder to detect that fraud. It's very harder
right.
to know in advance that all these people are going to show up. So
right.
there is a transparency and there's a kind of sunlight as disinfectants, you know, idea here. And
okay, so that's good. We're going to put these things on these exchanges. It's going to be more transparent. Are there parts of the derivatives legislation that, you know, are kind of analogs to the auto dealer carve out?
Oh, yeah.
Get out the carving knives.
The biggest one right out the door is something called the end user exemption, which says, If I'm an end user, if I'm using derivatives not to gamble on future stock prices, but just to hedge my own exposure. Classic one is the airline that wants to hedge fuel costs because, you know, they don't know what their fuel costs will be in the future. They don't have to follow those rules. What is scary here, and that is
scary because it seems like the obvious thing is to turn airlines into gambling houses.
Exactly. And you know, for some place that's kind of like a boring manufacturing firm to open up, you know, manufacturing firm, you know, derivatives dealer.
Ugh.
So that, if properly regulated, that won't explode, but it suddenly now becomes an enforcement issue. When you have this kind of are you on one side of the line or the other side of the line, rather than having a clear rule everyone has to follow, suddenly someone has to make that decision. That someone usually doesn't make a great decision right now.
Okay.
With the way we have our system.
All right. So let's move. I know we're doing this too quickly to, you know, this is like a 2,300-page bill. Resolution authority. That is, what do you do when a Lehman fails?
So this is a great idea in practice. They have legal powers to kind of go through a speed bankruptcy, might be one way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bankruptcy, but they'll go to a bankruptcy court. They'll say, can we do bankruptcy on this firm? Bankruptcy court and a couple other government officials will say yes or no. So there's accountability there.
Mm-hmm.
And then if no, then it will go to the FDIC, and the FDIC will try to unwind it over a weekend. This is a great power in theory. However, it's something that we haven't seen practiced
yet.
Yes, you know, exactly. We've not had, this is where I found something like breaking up the banks the most convincing, because FDIC works really great on your local bank, which maybe has $50 billion in assets. How well will it work on Bank of America that has $2 trillion in assets?
Jeez.
Well, we don't know, and we won't know until a very vulnerable point.
Yeah, and we won't know until a moment of total panic and crisis in which, as we saw with the bailout, I mean, all the sort of political pressures are sort of move in the direction of saving Wall Street's bacon.
Exactly. And also, in practice, a lot of this stuff will have a untested international dimension. So how do you resolve something like Citigroup, which may be in 100 countries right now, and probably more by the time, you know, the next crisis hits? That's scary. So that part of the bill is probably as good as it could be, given what they want to do. It's just a question of whether or not it can be done. So this is where you see a lot of people who wish we would have taken a little bit more preventative measures and,
right,
you know, harder size caps, breaking up the banks, you know, putting a couple really clear, hard rules into the
yes.
bill. So we don't have to rely so much on an untested
right.
solution.
That's right. Focus on the brakes on the car rather than the airbags, as it were.
Right. Resolution authority is like a really nice fire extinguisher if your house is always catching on fire.
Right.
So, you know, kind of, you also want to get some of the oily rags out
right.
of our
yes.
financial
that's
system.
Right. That's
but
that's
we have
that's
a really
good.
Shiny
fire. That's good.
Yeah, we have a really shiny fire extinguisher for the next crisis. So.
Okay, and finally, this last thing about sort of regulating the shadow banking system, bringing it under under kind of regulatory supervision.
So with shadow banking, we had two problems. One is, do we have the legal authority to, you know, regulate a non-bank as if it was a bank? And the second thing is, what kind of rules do we set up to have them follow in order to make sure we don't have crises like this? So the first part is definitely clear. We now have the legal authority to regulate large things that are shadow banks, things that are acting exactly like banks but don't have banking charters, so they avoid the rules. We have the legal authority to enforce banking rules on them, so they have
right.
to follow the rules like everyone else in their field. The problem is how to regulate them. That's largely going to be kicked to the international community, something called Basel III, which is this, you know, international agreement for how banks should regulate themselves. Basel III is being negotiated right now, and it's not clear how it's going to turn out. There's even more carve-outs because, you know, every nation wants their own particular style of banking sector to be carved out. U.S. are negotiating with the Canadians, negotiating with the French, and you know, that will be going on for the rest of the year. What we would like to see is basically banks hold a lot more capital. And people who are pushing for reform, people like AFR and A New Way Forward, we're looking for some like hard caps and hard rules to be put in, you know, a size cap, a basic minimum that even if the regulators just completely, you know, fall asleep at the wheel, there's still some level of cushion that will limit the damages. Largely, we didn't get that, which is we had a couple really important things. But in general, there's a lot of slack there that we would have liked to see picked up.
All right. That's a good rundown. I think there's two ways to look at this project of regulatory reform. One is reducing the likelihood and the possibly catastrophic consequences of financial crisis. The other is reversing the decade-long trend towards the financialization of the American economy and this kind of maldistribution of resources towards Wall Street, towards financial engineering, and to kind of rein in the size of Wall Street both as an economic and political entity. And my sense is that even if this does a decent job, we'll see on the first thing, it doesn't really address the latter thing.
No, not at all. You know, some of our most productive minds, instead of figuring out, you know, solar energy, will be going to designing computers to trade a millisecond ahead of your trades, you know, adding no productive value but making the top 1% significantly richer. And it will encourage firms to, you know, kind of come up with zany ways of hiding tax returns through financial engineering rather than coming up with innovative new products to make our lives better. It is unfortunate that it doesn't take on the culture of Wall Street. That's going to be a longer battle than, you know, the 2 years since the financial crisis. So that really is a generational transfer that needs to take place.
Mike Konzel, he is a former financial engineer, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and writes for Rorty Bomb. Mike, thanks so much.
No problem. Good. Thanks for having me.
The Breakdown is a weekly production of The Nation magazine and TheNation.com. New audiocasts are posted each Friday at TheNation.com and available on iTunes. The Breakdown was produced by Eric Nang and yours truly. The senior producers of The Nation are Emily Douglas and Ben Wiskita. Comments and feedback should be sent to TheBreakdown@TheNation.com.
Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? We're gonna run to all on that day.